Tonight, then, we'll talk about the section called Fundamentals of Shakyamuni's Philosophy. And there are three sections, or two sections in here that I wanted to... I'm going to assume that people have read it or not, and then I'm going to just comment on those sections and talk about the character of practice relative to them. So the first idea that he takes up is Buddhism as religion and what that means and the three treasures. And those three, those things are wrapped up together. The second section that we'll talk about tonight are the four marks of existence, or the four seals of existence, and how they relate to practice. So again, what I want to be emphasizing throughout this series is how practice, our practice, relates to these doctrinal ideas, these doctrinal issues, these traditional ideas in Buddhism. The three treasures in Buddhism are the Buddha, who is the historical Shakyamuni Buddha, the founder of religion. That's the sort of external meaning of the Buddha, who we take refuge in. We go to the Buddha for his advice. He's someone who we view as being wise and understanding the nature of life. And so in the sense that we go to him for advice about how to lead our lives, we're taking refuge in him. So we mean by taking refuge. There's another quality of Buddha, which is our inmost nature, our deepest nature, our real nature, the Buddha nature. And part of the internal aspect of the refuge of the Buddha is taking refuge in our own heart, our own experience, our own potential as Buddhas. The Dharma is the second of the treasures. The Dharma is the teaching, the truth, what the Buddha taught, the ideas that he passed on, the principles that he articulated. And also, the Dharma has come to mean the teaching of those who also understood what the Buddha understood. And so there's a whole vast array of Dharma literature, predominantly literature in the world, that's come out of the practice of people who are his followers. Again, we take refuge in those things by going to them for advice about our life, going to them for understanding about the nature of our practice, about the nature of life and our existence. The Sangha, the third of the three treasures, is those who practice the Dharma. Traditionally, the Sangha would have been, traditionally in ancient times, the Sangha would have the narrow connotation of being the monastic community, and those, again, who understood the teachings of the Buddha and are putting the teachings of the Buddha into practice and understanding those teachings. Over time, that external quality of the Sangha has also expanded to mean the four classes of Buddhists, particularly in the Mahayana world. The four classes of Buddhists are male and female monks and male and female lay people. And within those four classes of Buddhists, there is a wealth of deep understanding about the nature of the world, about how to put the Dharma into practice, about the nature of the Dharma. I should say that there's an inward quality of the Dharma refuge, and that is the truth that we learn in our experience. When we know for a fact that it hurts when we smack our foot against the table, that is a minor element of the Dharma, and we have that as a part of our experience. When we know for a fact that it hurts, it causes suffering when we act out of anger. That's part of our experience. That's part of our dharma. That's part of our understanding, the truth that we understand. Yes?
Could it be that just the truth that's taught by experience? Is that, I mean... Is,
yes, in the broadest sense, that is what I'm talking about. Yes, and so that is the sort of inward quality of our personal experience of the dharma. And that inward, all of these inward qualities are continually evolving and expanding, continually deepening. The inward, so the sangha are those people who practice, who are practicing the dharma, and those who understand the practice of the dharma. And again, we go to them in the sense we take refuge, we go to them for support and help with understanding and furthering our practice of the dharma. It's sort of on the inward level, the sangha can mean all those people with whom we live literally. Everybody that we come in contact with, there's a quality of sangha about that. They're teaching us something. Sometimes Buddhists teach us what to do, sometimes Buddhists teach us what not to do. And when we look at our relationships from this internal quality of practice, then we're learning something on the level of dharma and the three treasures from all of our interactions, where we have that potential. The three treasures are profound quality. And from the beginning of Buddhism, in order to be a Buddhist, all you had to do was say, I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha. And of course, then to do those things, to actually live according to the advice from those three treasures. That's all. Just having faith that that those three treasures embody something significant, embody something that will help us, is taking refuge in the three treasures. And that's what it, at the base, means to be a Buddhist. I always try to be really careful not to evaluate whether someone else is really practicing or not. And, well, you know, being discerning about it and all that. Because one of our teachers, Rev. Master Koten, was giving a Dharma talk in which he was talking about an ancient formulation of the precepts. And he was saying that one of the ways that the precept against not being proud of ourselves and devaluing others was to not cause other people to despair. And the tone of evaluating someone else's training, that kind of taking that position where, particularly as a monk and a teacher, I have to be really careful about this, of kind of saying, I know what practice is and you're not doing it. that's the sort of thing that can cause despair to arise. And while at times I kind of can look at someone and wonder, you know, it appears to me that they're sort of doing their best to look somewhere else other than practice for help and guidance. But to make that a private reflection and to not evaluate someone else's training, I think is quite important to me. Again, we just have to be practical and discerning as well at times. So it becomes then a personal matter whether we are practicing, whether we are Buddhists or not. It becomes a personal matter for us. And as I've said before, the Dharma is a sort of unstinting in generosity. If we make a small effort in the Dharma practice will give us something in return for that. If we make a moderate effort, it will give us a moderate return. If we make a large effort, if we give everything to the Dharma, then it will give us everything back. And it's just a matter of simple causality. What we do, we get the return for what we do. So the degree to which we want to understand and have the capacity to understand is the degree to which we take refuge in the three treasures, the time that we spend taking refuge in the three treasures, the time that we spend trying to understand our minds, the time that we spend trying to understand the Dharma. Now, there's an interesting quality about taking refuge in the three treasures. In our tradition, the ceremony of taking the precepts is called Kyoju Kaima, and it means the giving and receiving of the 10 precepts. And there's a quality, and or the 16 precepts, actually, although I don't think that's in the word. When we take the precepts in our tradition, we're taking the three treasures as precepts. We're promising to take refuge in the three treasures. And there's a quality of practicing to take refuge in the three treasures, of giving and receiving. When we start out, we're thinking to ourselves, and I think quite rightly, quite correctly, what can I get from practicing the Dharma? How can I use it to transform my life? How can I use it to deepen my understanding of life? How can I use it to awaken? What can I receive from the Dharma? But as we go into it, we realize that part of awakening is the mind of generosity, the mind of giving. And so our taking refuge in the three treasures is not just something that we receive from it, but is something that we give back to it. Each person that has showed up here tonight is giving something to the Sangha. They're receiving something, hopefully, but they're giving something to the Sangha. They're giving of their time and their life and their presence. And this is really, 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 really important. It's a really important aspect of it, particularly as we go along. I mean, in some sense, I could say, and this is really just some sense, I could say, I don't really need to be a monk. I don't really need to come to a group. I can just do practice. I know how to practice. I know how to train myself. I know how to train my mind. I don't really need this. I want to underline again, in some sense, and I'll explain that in just a minute. But part of me recognizes that I would not be where I am today if someone else had not given their time, their effort to the Sangha. And when I see those people who have given it, I realize that my claim to not really needing it, relative to what the understanding that I can see that they have and that I don't, is pretty lame. In other words, the people who have given me of their time are people who have a much deeper understanding than I do. And so for myself, it's not necessarily a sense of debt. It's more like a sense of wanting to give of my time and my of my life for the benefit of the Dharma. And there's a quality of, as we practice, as we train ourselves, there's a quality of opening up and discovering this part of ourselves, which, in a sense, wants to give back to the Sangha, wants to give back to life. There's a nice book written about this called The Mind of Clover by Robert Aiken, in which he talks about the quality of the generous mind that we discover from Zen practice is like, literally like the plant clover. You know, clover is a nitrogen-fixing plant. As it grows in the ground, it's putting nitrogen into the ground. It's basically giving something back. Its whole kind of life is giving something back to the ground. And that's how we, that's how our practice, where it goes to. And there's this, at this point then, so like for myself, again, I want to give, I recognize it's not absolutely essential for me to be part of the Sangha, but I want to give, and then I realize there is a very great value in my participating in the Sangha, in my participating in the three treasures. For one thing, and I think the predominant thing for me, is that my capacity for self-delusion is quite profound. My capacity for fooling myself is quite profound. My capacity to convince myself that things are otherwise than I think, than they actually are, is quite profound. And just the quality of showing up and associating with the Sangha day after day helps to rectify that, helps to address that issue. To me, that's really one of the main things about being part of a formal religious practice, is that is addressing that capacity for self-delusion. We set off on the road to awakening. We say to ourselves, there's got to be something more, in whatever way we say that. Something like, I've got to find something more to get away from this awful suffering that I'm in, or I just have the sense there's something better that I can find. And the Buddha says, okay, well, I have a sense for what that might be. If you want to follow this path, here's what you can do. My idea, the Buddha says in general, is that we obstruct our own self-nature. We obstruct our own understanding by our mistaken views and mistaken actions. So the first thing you need to do if you want to follow this path is to look within and rectify your own mistaken views and mistaken habits. So in other words, he turns us back on ourselves, turns us back on our minds. And the process of doing that, coming to understand where we obscure our own Buddha nature, where we sort of shoot ourselves in the foot, is a difficult process. It's quite difficult. And the support of the Sangha in particular, but the Three Treasures in general, is invaluable in that process. Because in a sense, we're coming to learn a different way of being. I was talking to somebody recently and they were saying, well, I can't be different than I am. And I understood that person, what they were trying to mean, but also, in a way, we have to be completely willing to, if we want to actually awaken, we have to be willing to be completely different than we are. We have to be willing to look at every aspect of our mind and life and say, I'll be willing to change that thing. Now, that's a pretty tall order, and happily we have time, and by time I mean the experience of living in time and a gradual process that we can go through to come to terms with that situation. But still, there it is. That's the deal. And then the next step that we're told to do is, well, now you have to accept yourself as you are. And so there's this constant tension, self-acceptance. I am as I am, and chances are I'm not really going to become a lot different than I am. And that's one of the main things that we need to keep working on changing, because much of our effort is to become somebody different than we are. So the three treasures are the beginning of practice. They're the first step that we take in becoming a Buddhist, in becoming a Zen practitioner. But they're also the foundation of practice all through our practice, all the way to the end. The Buddha himself was constantly taking refuge in the three treasures. He lived by alms. He lived by the offerings of the Sangha, basically. When the people in the area where he lived didn't have much, he didn't have much. I mean, there were periods of time when they were living on horse feed, basically, the monks, because there was famine. When he was making rules for the monastic community, he would consult the lay people about what needed to be done. Oftentimes, the lay people would come to him and say, this way of doing things doesn't really quite work. There was a story. There was a practice at the time where when people would sneeze, they would say the equivalent of "bless you." And so the Buddha's giving this Dharma talk, and he's explaining something quite complex, and these people start sneezing, and everybody's saying, "Bless you, bless you." And it makes this kind of ruckus, and he says, "All right, that's it. Nobody can say bless you anymore when you sneeze. I'm making this rule." Bless you, by the way. And, I can imagine him kind of being irritated and then going on with this talk, and then later, you know, they try that. They try doing that. And later some lay people come to him and say, you know, this doesn't really work. You know, it's what we do. It's how we conduct. It's how we're polite to one another. What do you think about changing that rule? And he's like, oh, okay, we'll change it back. And he let that rule go. He was constantly taking refuge in the community that he lived in. He, of course, lived according to his own dharma. He took refuge in Buddha nature within himself and lived from that. And he took refuge in the Sangha. He lived among the Sangha. And he lived within the conditions of the Sangha. Now, one of the things about taking refuge in the Sangha, about living, accepting the consequences of the Sangha that we live with, is that the people around us, we can start with this idea, the people around us oftentimes make our lives troublesome. They do things which are difficult and, you know, kind of up the pole sometimes. And part of our practice then is allowing that to happen and accepting the consequences of that and then learning from that, allowing that to deepen our practice. Of course, then the next step is we have to recognize that sometimes I am going to make life difficult for my community. I am going to make life difficult for the Sangha. And boy, isn't it great that you all are willing to put up with me. And really, I quite appreciate that. And that's part of that giving and receiving quality that we bring to our taking refuge in the Sangha. The Chinese have this idea that they say the Sangha is like a forest. In a forest where there are many trees, all the trees grow strong, straight, and tall. In a forest where there aren't many trees, trees can go crooked and grow all over the place. And if you just walk around and see a forest where there are a lot of trees, this is how it is true. So as we are growing together in the Sangha, unwittingly, in a lot of ways, the Sangha is keeping us growing straight and tall. Now, the issue of religion, whether or not Buddhism is a religion, and how that's related to the three treasures. There are a number of, for a variety of reasons, historically, when Buddhism came to the West, or Westerners encountered Buddhism, it was encountered by a number of basically Christian academics. And when they were talking about Buddhism, they found it appealing, the ideas appealing, but they couldn't really admit that it was a religion and still be interested in it, because the way that Christianity was conceived of didn't allow for that. So, in part, they started talking about Buddhism as if it were a philosophy of life, an ethical system. But at the center of the three treasures is simple faith in the three treasures, the idea of faith. We're told the three treasures. I'm sitting here telling you the three treasures embody all this great wisdom and all this stuff. And on the ground, what we encounter is a bunch of people who look like they may or may not know what they're doing most of the time. And so there's a quality in which we have to say, okay, I'm going to have faith. I'm going to trust that there is something more going on in the Sangha, even though I may not see it. And sometimes our faith is tested more or less. Things which we would really rather didn't happen. People in the Sangha do things which they really hadn't ought to do, and all that kind of thing. And so what we're asking ourselves is to continue to have faith that there's a deeper quality to the three treasures. I mean, even the act of sitting down in meditation is an act of faith. It's an act of trusting something that we don't necessarily see. I mean, you sit down and you look at a wall for half an hour, it's kind of crazy. You know? but when you do, and so just getting yourself there to your seat and taking the step of sitting down is an act of faith. And it continues to be an act of faith even when we start to have the experience that it does benefit us. There was I had this dog one time, which I sort of moved into this house, sort of inherited this dog, who I really liked. It was a golden Labrador, kind of young, named. He was originally named B4 for the cage that he came out of at the animal shelter, but I changed his name to Max. So I had this dog, and I was pretty young and energetic too, sort of stupid like Max was. But so I walked up the street to get some ice cream at the ice cream parlor, and I left the dog outside. And while it was outside, got hit by a car. So I come out of the ice cream parlor, and there's a dog in the gutter, not dead yet, but kind of dying. And I recognize this is my fault. I did this stupid thing. I didn't tie the dog up properly, and he got loose. So I was, trying to calm the dog. It was clearly pretty beat up and on its way out. And he bit me while he was dying, because I was in a lot of pain. And it wasn't kind of real serious or anything. It was more like he was kind of telling me, boy, I wish you had been more responsible. It was pretty upsetting to me. And one of the things that I was just starting my meditation practice at the time. I think I was like 19. And I had read somewhere that a meditator, instead of going, in times of difficulty, instead of going and lying down on their bed, they'll go and do meditation. They'll go to meditation as their place of refuge. And as I say, this was upsetting to me because I loved the dog and I was really stupid, and it resulted in that dog's death. So I went home and did meditation. And this was, to me, what I'm talking about as an act of faith. That this idea that just sitting still and offering merit and just trying to look at my own mind was going to be one of the best ways that I could deal with the turmoil that was caused by the passing away of this dog. And during this time, again, I was a young person. There's all kinds of, my friends are all having fun in various ways. And I'm deciding, okay, I'm gonna meditate. I'm going to take refuge in the Three Treasures. And that meant not having fun on Wednesday night and going to the classes, at the Priory. And this is an act of faith again. I'm going to set aside this idea of having fun for the moment, and I'm going to go and learn about the Dharma. And in this way, we gradually begin to take refuge in the Three Treasures. We put our time and effort into the Three Treasures as a refuge. And, honestly, being a monk, you can imagine I've kind of set aside a fair number of things in order to be a monk and to take refuge in the Three Treasures. And that's what's come up for me to do, and I don't really, I'd be frankly quite surprised if other people do it. But again, the degree to which we can offer our time and life to the Three Treasures, that is of great merit and value, both during times of difficulty for us, but also for all beings, for the beings that we encounter. It was actually a great solace to sit in meditation after Max passed away. That helped me. That helped me to understand it and be able to deal with it. And hopefully it will it helped me to really look at my own irresponsibility and kind of come to terms with that and be more responsible. So then I had a dog later on who lived to a ripe old age, and I didn't get killed. So you see what I hope you see what I'm getting at. There's a quality of faith that we enact when we take refuge in the three treasures. And because of that quality of faith, what we're doing is a religious practice. There's a deeper quality of this, which is not mentioned in this book. Religion is the word, the root of the word religion comes from the idea of reconnecting. Religion, re means to do it again. Ligios is the same root as ligature, you know, like sewing up or ligaments, that connection. And so part of what we're doing in our religious practice is reconnecting with that deepest quality of ourselves, with Buddha nature. And because there is that quality of meditation as well, then on a more profound level, what we're doing is a religious practice. And so that's something also to bear in mind. So that's the three treasures and the idea of Buddhism as a religion. Is there any questions about that? I'm just trying to think. It's getting a little bit late, and so I may well, let me just say the next section are about the four marks of existence and impermanence. The four marks of existence are impermanence, no abiding separate self, the idea that nirvana exists, in other words, enlightenment exists, and suffering exists. These are the four marks of existence. These four marks of existence are ideas that permeate all of Buddhism and are essential for a deeper understanding and practice of the Dharma. So the next time we talk, I think we'll talk about the four marks of existence and begin to talk about causality. Causality, again, there are some in the West, and this is a more modern phenomenon, who believe that you can teach about what the Buddha taught and not include causality, particularly the law of karma and dependent origination, where it takes into consideration rebirth, reincarnation. And I kind of understand where they're coming from, but I'm a little puzzled about that, just as a, you know, I guess my academic background rears its head there and says, well, you can't really have Buddhism. I mean, if you read about what the Buddha taught, you can't really have Buddhism without dependent origination, causality, and karma. I mean, that's sort of what Buddhism is about. You can meditate and not think about those things, but eventually, if you follow the path that the Buddha set out, you're going to encounter causality. What I do has effects. And so that will be what we begin to talk about next time. So, again, any questions? Okay. Well, thank you. Oh, did you have anything?
I didn't. this week, so no questions.